Okay, my name's Stuart Cunningham. I'm from the BBC, and I'd like to talk to you about inkjets. Take this television production system we've been trialling and using for some productions in the BBC. In case you haven't heard the name before, British Broadcasting Corporation is the largest broadcasting corporation in the world, and at the moment they have 8 free-to-air television channels. And that's not including what they call interactive, which are extra video streams you can access with your red button on the remote. There's quite a few productions going on at any one time. And productions often have finite budgets in what equipment they can use to do their production. The scope of inkjets is to get video, audio, timecode, and other metadata from the studio, depicted on the left, through into the post-production edit suite. The camera you see on the left in the studio, that's a Digibeta camera, and it has a number of cables coming out of it, mostly analog video or analog audio, but one of them is an SDI stream, that's serial digital interface, that's a broadcast standard for connecting equipment in television broadcasting. And that's where we intercept the footage and record it rather than it going to tape inside the camera, and then the tape would be brought into the studio, played back in a tape machine, and editing would proceed from there. But there's a couple of videotapes. They're digital videotapes, and they're stored digitally on the videotape, but it's not as a file on, as you would be familiar with, data tape. So before you can start editing it, you've got to ingest the tape, what we call ingest, which is really just playing it back, and then a different process takes that digital stream and records it into a file. Digital tapes are slow. If you want to copy a tape, you can only do it in real time. You have a 60-minute tape, it takes 60 minutes to copy. And the ingest stage can be error-prone, in addition to just time-consuming, and quite expensive as well. Those Doozy Pro 50 tape decks there, they would be around about $40,000 each, and that's only for recording four cameras. If you have a production where you need 7 cameras or 8 cameras, it really does start to add up. The key to solving the digital tape problem has been files, and the key standard here is the Material Exchange Format, MXF. It's been standardized by the Society of Motion Picture Television Engineers, and it's now widely supported in cameras, VTRs, editing systems, and all sorts of other hardware and software that you'll find, including our software, inkjets, now. The cameras are quite expensive. The Panasonic P2 camera, a Grass Valley camera, Sony XDCam camera, they all call to different mediums. One uses memory sticks, 8 gigabyte or 16 gigabyte memory sticks in the camera. Others use Blu-ray discs, that's the Sony XDCam. Grass Valley, they have called to a kind of little hard disk drive. Just to give you an idea of the comparison of what you can store on digital videotape versus as files on a disk. The stack of Digibeta tapes on the right is equivalent to what can be stored on that 1 terabyte USB drive. It's quite an old, I think it's about 2 years old, that photo, so the 1 terabyte drive is about half the size now. In order to get a system to work with the post-production side of television production, we needed to support the video formats that they use. And it breaks down into two kinds, what we call online, and this is the much higher quality footage which is used to produce the finished work, to conform the finished work before it's broadcast. And uncompressed is quite heavy on the bitrate, and that's 8 bits per sample. That's used by productions who want to do a lot of chroma key or doing compositing, special effects. They need very high bitrate, the uncompressed video, so that any compression artifacts don't show up in their processing. Some will also use 10 bits per sample for advanced keying things. Digibeta tape, it's not a file format, it's actually a proprietary format that only exists on the Digibeta tape itself. You can't get out the bitstream. Those tape decks cost at least $50,000, $60,000. So I haven't seen any hacks where people have cracked them open and had a play with them, see if they can sniff the bitstream. So we don't know what's really going on there, but I've read that it's 88 megabits per second. MJPEG 2:1, that's probably much more common in post-production. It's roughly 2:1. And although JPEG itself is a standard, an open standard, the motion JPEG format isn't standardized, and so everyone who has been using JPEG in video, they have their own ways of joining the pictures together, splitting them up. For interlaced video, for example, often one field will be split out into a half a picture, coded as one JPEG, then the other field is another JPEG, and the bit streams can come together that way. So we have to do a little bit of reverse engineering of the particular JPEG format that the editors we were targeting were using to get that to work. DVC Pro 50 is a standard that's used by other productions which don't need quite the high bit rate of 2:1. And IMX 50, one of the lower qualities of online, that's used by news. There they have less demand for quality, but more demand for fast turnaround, being able to fit more data on it. Particular medium. Offline, these are the formats used to do most of the editing in post-production, and they like it to be very small file sizes, so the bit rates show you they're much smaller, and allows them to scrub through footage very quickly, to log it very quickly, to combine it, and it's really can be quite difficult sometimes. I find the MJPEG 20:1 quite difficult to actually watch, but some editors prefer that over some of the high bitrate ones, simply because it's just that little bit faster when using, when editing. So here's an overview of the Inject system, the low-cost file-based production system. From the studio, video, audio, and timecode, that's uncompressed video and audio, timecode, sometimes some other metadata, will be captured in just an everyday PC. The only thing special about it is that we'll have an SDI capture card, which you don't find down at the corner shop. There, it can range from $1,000 to $5,000, depending on what you need to capture. That's usually the most expensive part of the systems that we've been using. We do a software encode using mostly FFmpeg, sometimes libjpeg with some other code around that. And then we write NXF files using a library we've written to support NXF called libNXF. Now, there were other libraries out there that did NXF. Some of the licenses weren't compatible with what we were doing. But mostly, they couldn't have the low-level access that we needed to produce NXF files that would be compatible with a wide range of equipment. For example, the P2 camera needed the video to start on a certain byte boundary within the stream, and many of the other NXF libraries didn't support the ability to arrange padding and byte boundaries at the necessary points. So once it's been written as an NXF file, it can go onto a NAS server, or more often than not, we put it onto a little portable USB drive, and that's couriered from the studio up to post-production. Tends to be a lot of post-production in Manchester. A lot of shooting tends to be done in London. But a few different productions work that way. Overall, we do both. The goal of this is to get rid of all of the tape, so we need to support both the online and the offline versions. So I'll describe how it was used in one production called Dragon's Den. This is the show where you have some multimillionaires, the dragons, and a number of entrepreneurs who come before them and pitch their idea and invention, product, and try to get some money out of them for the invention. And because it can be quite dramatic the way the responses of the dragons proceed, it's not something that you can say, that take was no good, go back, do it again. It's much more like a live shoot, and so they needed as many cameras as possible. In fact, they used 7 cameras to capture all of the angles, as many reactions as they can. So that's from the other side of the photo. Looking at the studio, you can see 3 cameras being set up there. They're all digipeater cameras, and we were recording the SDI, the Archivist video and audio SDI output from those. Because there were 7 cameras, we needed to break it up across 2 PCs, Injects Recorder 1, Injects Recorder 2. 4 inputs going into one, 3 into the other. They were just everyday quad-core machines, not top of the line, because we were only compressing to one of the lower bitrate JPEG formats used for offline editing. All stuck on a gigabit network with just an ordinary controller PC, with controls for starting and stopping recordings. This is standard definition of particular production. So that's the shot from the gallery. There's 7 monitors there, which the director uses to direct the action. And stuck in the corner of this porta cabin was our controller PC. And there you can see a simple user interface for starting and stopping the action. We can enter a little bit of metadata there, and you can monitor what's going on in the little monitor window there. Now, our equipment is on the left-hand side of that table. The other half is for other monitoring purposes. And we've just got 2 PCs under the table there with 7 SDI cables plugged into the back of it. One key thing about this system, which saves a lot of time in post-production, is the creation of an AAF file. You may not have heard of AAF. It stands for Advanced Altering Format. And it's an open standard, which BBC has also put a lot of effort into to make work, so that you can get a work in progress out of one editor into another editor and preserve all the edits, all the effects, as much information as possible. And here we use it so that at the end of the day's shooting, you may have collected 1,000 files, different files, and that can be quite a lot to manage. And the AAF file collects them all together so that when you come into the edit suite, you just drag that one file, drop it into what's called a bin in the editing user interface, and it collects together all the files and allows you to navigate them very quickly. So once the USB drive arrived in post-production, the MXF-AF files copied off the drive, AF files dragged into the avid editing bin, and in this case, they started editing using the offline, the 10:1 JPEG files, but because we weren't recording the high quality in this production, they would then conform directly from digibeta tape. So they may have finish their edit. There might be 1,000 different cuts between sources, and the conform stage is where they hit a button on the editor and it starts asking you to feed tapes in. So it would tell you, feed in this tape, this number, and feed the digibeta tape in. It might take only 2 seconds from that one, and then ask for the next tape, and you feed that tape in. So although we saved an awful lot of time of ingesting for the offline edits, for doing the offline edit, you need all the tapes. There might be, with 7 cameras, you'll have each tape might be stored about 40 minutes. At the end of the day, you might have 50, 60 tapes. Someone has to sit there and feed all of those in, usually throughout the night. And it'll be played back in real time so they can start editing in the morning. So we saved that time, but we did save the time conforming from digibeta tape, which lot less time because not as many tapes need to be fed in, only the bits that were used in the edit, but it's still something we wanted to eliminate. The next production was a music video for the band Foo Fighters, a rock band apparently. And in this case, they needed a very fast turnaround. And so we're aiming to do both formats, the high quality online and the offline. In this case, the high quality online wasn't really what most productions would consider online. It was actually DV, that was DV25. But because it was being produced for a web format and for a digital TV interactive stream, that is in addition to those 8 channels I showed before, this would be another stream which you can access with your red button. They didn't need the same high quality offline formats. So we used the same equipment and we just added the extra step of producing the DV encodings in parallel, just using SSMPEG. We still need the quad-core CPUs to be able to do all of this in real time. We wrote it to a USB drive. It was then couriered up from a club in Brighton, in the south coast of England, to London, and produced the next day and transmitted. There's a photo of the gallery in this case, a little bit more cramped than the port cabin, and we actually have some equipment overflowing to the toilet. You can see it resting on the toilet bowl at the back there. Thermal management was a bit of a problem, a bit ad hoc, but it still worked. And there's the recording PCs with the little USB drives you can just see resting under the monitors. There's a glimpse also of some of the video feeds that are being recorded, and again, the user interface. There's the time code. 17 hours, 29 seconds, 20 frames in that particular photo. That time code's been captured along with the video and audio from the SDI stream. The next big production was EastEnders, a serial drama. It used to be broadcast on the ABC. I don't know what's happened to it. But, yeah. Here, it's a continually produced drama. And there they're very strict on protocol for their storage. They had some, I think at the time they were using about 4 terabytes of storage. And so one of the constraints there with these continually editing programs is to make sure they're not running out of storage. And so they only bring as much content onto their storage as will fit to do the edit. So most of the time they're using tapes. We thought we could change all of that, so we tried our Injex recorder. And here they were using DVC Pro 50 and JPEG 20:1 for their offline. We provided a run-of-the-mill Linux NAS server running Samba with a bunch of disks. 10 terabyte storage was more than they'd ever seen before, and much cheaper than what they were used to. And that all sat on a Gigabit Ethernet network where their Avid Media Composer editing workstations could access. So that was the storage server, just a no-name brand rack mount PC running Linux and Samba. We wanted to use a very cheap switch as well, but some of the runs in this environment were more than 100 meters, so we had to use a switch that could support fiber, just to get from post-production to the studios. And that control the system from the EastEnders gallery. They're still using tape. I couldn't encourage them to drop tape altogether and rely on our system. So the resource manager in the gallery would record that tape and then control our system in parallel. We still have quite a few problems. But it was mostly with legacy equipment used in post-production. They had some very old versions of the editors, which although they supported NXF, they had some dark metadata, what we call dark metadata, which is metadata that is not meant to be exposed in interchanges of NXF files. So we had to reverse engineer enough of that so the Avid editors could understand the NXF files we were producing. And they had another curious problem with an ancient version of the audio tool Pro Tools, where it needed a particularly esoteric crafting of a mob ID, that's a material object ID, just a unique number to identify a clip of video or audio. So we had to reverse engineer the particular format they were looking for just to be able to get audio to flow through the whole system. Also had a few network problems, and it was mostly due to network cards not being on their own bus, and simply solved by replacing network cards, putting them on the right PCI bus. So rough specs of the system: a run-of-the-mill quad core. We're now using a single machine with dual quad cores, not the high-end dual quad cores, just the middle of the range quad cores. 4 gigabytes of RAM. That was quite useful because we used a very large ring buffer, which I'll get to in a moment, to buffer the video, the uncompressed video. And we usually have a couple terabytes of just fast file system storage for storing these multiple streams of 50 megabit or 70 megabit video and audio for storage. The only thing special about the system are the capture boards. We use the DVS and Taurus cards. And these boards can capture two SDI or HD SDI inputs in one board, so we need to put two boards in. And just OpenSUSE, it doesn't really matter what distribution, so long as they have the XFS file system supported. But I think Red Hat comes with XFS out of the box. But with all the testing of file systems that we did, we found XFS had the best performance, both for CPU and I/O, to get streams of very, very high bitrate streams of video going to disk at the same time. So inside injects, these are the main components. The circled or ringed words are the processors. And the reason we designed it this way was a shared memory ring buffer would store the uncompressed video and audio and act as a way of modularizing the system so that when we use different hardware, we can just interchange the processors for the capturing of it, and for the reading of the video and audio, we have different processors doing different things. So a Corda is the one using libmxf and ffmpeg to write the files. Player is used for monitoring. And that multicast process, Nexus Multicast, is used to write a quarter picture version of the uncompressed video to a multicast address so that anyone on the network can monitor the stream. And we thought about different ways of doing that, but let the network switch to the hard work of sending it everywhere to have as many people monitoring it as possible. The ring buffer was useful not just for modularizing it from differences in the hardware capture process, but it became quite important when we needed to offer a pre-roll feature. So in the studio, they might call out action, but they've actually missed a few seconds of action. But because we're continually recording into this large ring buffer, we can have up to a minute worth of pre-roll. So when they start recording, they actually get a minute's worth or 30 seconds or whatever of footage already recorded. The ring buffer was also useful for smoothing out the problem with real-time encoding of hard pictures. We found that there was a difference, a factor of four difference, between coding something easy like a darkly lit room or black picture versus something difficult like a very well-lit studio or static, fast motion, yes, or something which tends to happen more often than not is unplugging one camera, move the camera, plug it back in, you get a few seconds of static, which the system doesn't realize is static and tries to code all of that information. And that, if we were getting a constant stream of that, we would fall behind what we could do in real time. but luckily it's only a second or two, and the large ring buffer helps to smooth out that, and we never get in trouble running out of space in the buffer. So these were the major software components we used at the FEMPEG. It didn't support DVC Pro 50, so we contracted Dan Mass, who contributed FFmpeg before, and he did a very good job writing a codec to encode, decode DVC Pro 50. In fact, his software produced a higher quality video compared to the hardware encoders that were thousands, tens of thousands of dollars, and it could do it in real time on reasonable hardware. DV and IMX were already in FFmpeg. We used libjpeg for the mjpeg format. We had to do, there are other JPEG libraries out there, but it's quite an old library. I think it hasn't really changed since 1994 or 1996. But it did the job, and it supported the 422 color space sampling that we needed. We did have to reverse engineer things a little bit and then repack, disassemble the header of the JPEG and repack it in a certain way that the Avid needed before it would leave it. And libmx is the library which we've written so that we can have this very low level ability to read and write and access files the way we need them. We've recently tested HD flowing through the whole system, and on the same hardware we can record two HDSDI streams in either DVC Pro HD, which is a format that can support 1080p, 1080i and the 720p resolutions, and VC3. Now, earlier, and we've talked about VC1, which is Microsoft standardization of their Windows Media Codec. Dirac is at VC2. It's actually a third one in the Synthi slot, which is VC3. And that's really only a high-end HD codec for editing. So quite high bit rates. Certainly not that would be broadcast or that you'd use on the web. Not yet, at least. But we've had that flowing through the system, so we can use the same hardware to do two streams on the 120 megabits or 185 megabits DNX HD. And I was told last month that there's no hardware that can do this either, so we're the only ones with a single box, that can do two streams of the 185 megabit version. There's the website. All of the source code is available. Libmxf is there, the other source code that we used. A few other tools, such as our JPEG bitstream dumper, so if you need to reverse engineer and JPEG formats. It's all there on the website. There's also a little 8-minute video of an early version of the system being used in a production from 2005, sort of a behind-the-scenes video, if you want to have a look at that. Any questions? Yes. It's not a government entity. It's actually an independent corporation, but it's publicly funded through the license fee. So everyone with a television in the UK has to pay £130, £140 a year. License fee to have that television, and they have detector vans going around the streets enforcing it. So that gives the BBC independence, and so they, from the government, and so they have their own board, and they own the copyrights of things that they produce. BBC has been involved in open source for quite a while. I think one of the earliest things they released was called Betsy, which was a useful tool for web publishing and producing different formats on a web page for the visually impaired. And we've been releasing other things along the way. We've been heavily involved in MXF and AAF standardization, and along with that, we've released toolkits to reference implementations of the standard, to promote the standard and help that along. So for things like this, where it benefits the industry and we get the feedback and it benefits the BBC, it's quite straightforward to release it. Legal status, well, it's copyright LGPL. Right. They're not used in anything. Yeah. I think there are some patents on some of these, but they don't seem to be enforced. So I think the DV format, you can find patents talking about DCT blocks and so on, but no one seems to be enforcing them. JPEG is fine as well. There's one of the formats was IMX, which is actually MPEG-2 video iframe only. But there's not much you can say patentable about that because it's just DCT blocks and there's no motion estimation, none of the fancy stuff. It's just a very constrained version of MPEG. I didn't tend not to worry about patents because they're different in every country. In Europe, it's difficult to work out what's going on. The law says no, there are no. You cannot have patents on mental methods, programs for computers, mathematical expressions. You know, the whole list of exceptions that can't be patented. So difficult to know. I just ignore the issue and get on with the work. Well, I wish I could try out iPlayer and use it, but I don't run Windows, so I haven't been able to try it out and see whether it works or not. It doesn't work under Linux. Well, that's all I can say, is that I haven't tried it out. I can't use it on my system at home. I do have access to some Windows machines on the BBC network, but they're all via VNC and in virtual machines, not suitable for playing that video. Yeah, it would be, they're sort of the next steps, is once we've got it working into productions, and the productions I've mentioned have actually used our files, and EastEnders was the last few blocks that they conformed and then broadcast used nothing from the tapes recorded in the studio. They used our files for the online and our files for the offline. So we know it works. The fact that we're getting content onto networks and onto file servers would mean that, yes, it's already in the form. But what we're doing really is only the rushes stage, so it might only be useful for live events where you need the rushes quickly to edit them. iPlayer is for finished programs that have already been broadcast. So I think what they would do is effectively take it out of the broadcast server or take it out of the archive and make it available that way. So we're quite disconnected from that. There was another question here. Consumer hard drives fail all the time. Yeah, everyone knows that. So we use RAID 5 on the big server. We got away without using RAID 5 just yet in our recording system, but the next version we'll definitely be using probably hardware provided RAID 5. It starts to increase the cost of things a bit, but it's certainly worth it now that we've proven it works. Productions are going to really start relying on it. Yes, we'll have multiple copies. We'll have a couple of different USB drives which have backups of it. We thought about that, so having complete redundancy that way. So if something goes wrong, we can unplug the SDI cables, plug them in, or even have them connected up to what's called a SDI removable switch. And so switch it immediately and lose perhaps even a frame or two, nothing more. That would double the cost, but we're already much cheaper than the alternatives. So it's certainly something we've started talking about for the next stage, which is really getting more productions using it and rolling it out a bit more. Well, we did a prototype back in 2005, and now we call it really trial stage. So productions who are willing to have a couple of extra bits of kit lying around their studio, we've been working with them, and so far it's all worked quite well, and they've been using our files instead of tape in post-production. So really it's a reliability that we perhaps completely redundant systems that we need to use next to have productions move entirely away from tape. Although we wouldn't want them to, tape is still useful, even though they're quite expensive machines and so on. Obviously, it's still useful as a backup. So that's what we think the next stage is. Productions will expect to use our system for all of the online and offline encodings, and only use tape if something catastrophic goes wrong with our side of things. Yes, we've got a couple of interested broadcasters in Europe. A Belgian broadcaster, another German one. The big one? The national one. And I noticed there was a place from nine Australians here. Perhaps they might be interested in it. It's all the software is there. We've got RPMs for Suzy's, just the particular distribution we like to use. Anyone can get a PC. The only thing special will be the hardware, the SDI capture card, and something else to feed SDI to it. Yeah. For our prototype system back in 2005, we couldn't encode in real time. The hardware wasn't fast enough. So what we did was write uncompressed and then code after this. So they're big files to play with, but it still worked. We encode in non-real time, and it wasn't a fast turnaround production, so it was fine. We still produced the files that they used, they still transmitted from our files. So quite a few things have changed. In a very early system, we didn't use a file system. We just wrote to the raw block device. And that actually had a speed up of close to double from using a file system. File system is a bit better now, so you don't get that same speed up. If we're desperate, we can't go back and get double the performance by going back to block device for writing files. Yeah, things have changed quite a bit. The kernel latencies are much better. The hardware is a bit more stable now as well, the SDI interface. Yeah. One little side project I looked at about a year and a half ago was using it for very low budget production, multi-camera production. So you might have a bunch of FireWire cameras around the studio instead of the expensive SDI cameras. And then using a couple of FireWire, multi-port FireWire cards. And it all should be straightforward. That code probably is not a bit rot now, so just a little bit of cleanup could get that back in. And the modular structure would make it very easy just to plug straight in. So instead of the devious SDI process there, we would have a multiple FireWire capturing something like DB grab could be hacked together very quickly, I think, and would plug straight in. For in digital cinema production? Yes, they started using 2K pictures. That's about 2,000 pixels across, and now they use 4K. They tend to do a lot with uncompressed, even though they're huge files. They use uncompressed. The SDI is too well. HD SDI can do some of the film formats now. They can do some of the 2K or 4K formats. But you have, I think, what you call dual link or quad loops. So you need to sort of have four cables of HD SDI to get the very highest film. So they tend to just stick with what they do already, which I think is just storing large compressed files. It's not all videotape, let me say that. It's now data tape. So instead of videotape, which they've got a nice graph somewhere of the different formats through the years, from the old analog formats through quarter inch, pneumatic, Betacam, all the different formats, how when a tape format comes to the end of its life, it has to be played out and then re-recorded on the next format, and then at the end of that life into another one. And so we've just last year started a project called the D3 Digital Archive, and one of the slides I used at the very beginning is of a shelf in the D3 Archive that we're moving away from. This one here, they're D3 tapes. And all of those are now being converted over to files, but because we can't afford all of it to be sitting online, they're now going on to LTO3 tapes. And that's what all the banks and other companies use to store their data online. There'll be a few, it's mostly finished productions. There'll be a few Russia's tapes in there as well, but because they just take up so much space, Russia's tape tends to get thrown away or reused, never used. Yes? Yes. Well, it's quite interesting. Have you got half an hour? A lot of it was simply thrown out, so some of it wasn't even recorded. The very early Doctor Who, although some of the early episodes may have been colour, they were recorded onto film, black and white film, and then sold to the US and Australia and Canada. And because it's been spread around like that, that's how we've been able to recover it. So we've got, for restoring one video, program of Doctor Who, we've got a colour VHS recording from the US and a black and white recording from Australia, and combine the two, taking the colour from there, although it's much poorer quality because it's from VHS, there was a high quality black and white recording, combine the two, a bit of processing, and now you can buy it from BBC Worldwide as a DVD. Yes, in fact, a couple of my colleagues who've worked on some of the components of this also worked on that restoration project. And there was another one called Reverse Standards Conversion, where Doctor Who episodes went to the US, and so their standards converted using this huge bit of equipment in the 1960s, in the early 70s, great big cabinet like this, which was a field store, which was quite advanced reverse standards conversion to be able to store a line and convert it. So what they did was write some software which did the inverse of that. They still had some of the equipment so they could work out exactly what was going on. write some software to reverse that, and now they reverse standards converted. The only remaining footage, which was in US NTSC format, and a bit more processing, a bit more cleaning up, and got some very, very decent quality recovered episodes. There's still a bunch of episodes out there missing. There's a website maintained with a list of all the missing episodes. So if you come across some tape that look like this, or even larger ones which are sort of this thick by these dimensions, it might well be a might well be a missing Doctor Who episode. Well, perhaps there's someone in the BBC trawling through eBay looking for these episodes. Yeah. Well, we can do a quick calculation. There's about 1 million tapes, and tapes vary between 30 to 60 minutes, so let's say 45 minutes on average. And it's probably, when we're archiving it, we're actually archiving the uncompressed video. Because the video has gone through a number of stages, it's lost a bit of information along the way. We don't want to compound the problem by encoding in IMX50 or one of these other compressed formats. So we're storing it uncompressed, the best quality we can. Because we know in the future it'll be reused in HD, and say HD, you'll be able to see the problems that were caused at this stage. So importing that, so we're storing it uncompressed. Typically, it'd be 50, 60 gigabytes for one program. So 100, oh, let's say 1 million tapes times 50, 60 gig. One. Have a. There. Yeah, that's nothing. Yeah.
That's a lot.
Oh, it is a lot. Yeah. Yeah, so that's why we're using LTO3 tapes to store it, rather than putting it all online on spinning disks.
Well, no, sorry,
when I say online, it's online. Okay, yeah. Actually, you mean by robotic tape?
Yes.
Yeah, well, we find human robots are much cheaper than robotic tapes. So, because these are accessed very infrequently, if you've got a robotic system, you need to be accessing it to justify the cost. So, you know, human robots will go and pick up the tape and plug it in. That's the biggest problem that we considered. And that's the biggest problem. The D3 tapes, they stopped being supported a few years ago, and they stopped manufacturing spare parts 2 years ago. So, and the BBC, I think, now has the largest collection of spare D3 machines, because they know that they're going to fail. They can pinch spare parts from the remaining ones just to keep this going. It's going to take 5 years to get all of those tapes into files. But we'll be storing it in the LTO tape format. The good thing about that, it's an open standard. There are multiple vendors using it. So down the track, if we have problems, we can go back to the spec and rebuild tape drive even. Yes, but we're not going to keep it on LTO3 tape forever. We know that we're going to be moving to the next format, perhaps when disks become affordable, or perhaps flash, who knows, in 10 years' time, what's going to be the best way to keep things going. But the thing is, once we produce the file now in this one last transfer from videotape, it stays as a file forever. And the same file, we don't need to touch it. Just have to keep it moving onto good mediums. Yeah. Okay, sorry.